You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 22nd of February 2012 on Monocle 24. And a warm welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24. We're live from Studio One in London. I'm Emma Nelson. In the next 60 minutes, we'll be talking to the author of a book which claims that language doesn't come from within, but is a product of our culture.
Language is invented by humans and human societies to solve the problem of forming communities, because humans are social creatures and we need to establish communities.
Dubai says it wants to become the new cultural capital of the Gulf, but with projects in Abu Dhabi, Oman and Qatar well underway, how will Dubai make its mark? Also, China bans the F word, Ferrari that is. We'll be looking at the story of censorship. And how's this for a winter warmer? We'll be talking street food in Helsinki, served at minus 20. All that plus some great music. That's right here on Midori House on Monocle 24. But before all that, let's get the latest news from around the world with James Luckhurst.
Monocle 24 News. More than a dozen people have died in clashes across Syria today. In the worst incident, 10 civilians, including 3 children and 2 women, died when their small bus was destroyed in the northern town of Sermin as they tried to flee to Turkey. The UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon said yesterday's unanimous Security Council statement had sent a clear message to Syria to end all violence, but Damascus appeared to dismiss the document. At least 8,000 people have died in the year-long revolt against President Bashar al-Assad, according to UN figures issued a week ago. Rebel troops in the African country of Mali say they've seized control hours after attacking the presidential palace. A spokesperson for the rebels appeared on state television to announce that the constitution was to be suspended and state institutions dissolved. A 23-year-old gunman who said Al-Qaeda inspired him to kill 7 people in France has been shot dead by police commandos as he tried to escape from his apartment building in Toulouse. The man, Mohamed Merad, died from gunshot wounds at the end of a 30-hour standoff with police after confessing to killing 3 soldiers, 3 Jewish children and a rabbi. The British Foreign Secretary William Hague has been in Italy in an attempt to restore good relations between the two countries following the failed Nigerian hostage raid 2 weeks ago. Chris McManus from the UK and Franco Molinaro from Italy were kidnapped in May last year while working for a construction company in northwestern Nigeria. They were killed by their captors during a rescue raid that included British soldiers. Mr. Hague explained why his government had taken the action.
We have done everything we possibly could under these terrible circumstances since the 12th of May last year, working with Italy to try to save the lives of both hostages, and took the action we did because we thought it was the best hope.
The Italian Foreign Minister Giulio Terzi said Italy understood the difficulty of the situation.
I cannot hide the fact that we were strongly disappointed by the fact by not being able to be informed before the moment the operation was launched, but we all take note also on the aspect of the very difficult situation which existed on the ground and the very fast development of the circumstance.
Mr. Hague said he believed Thursday's meeting had been beneficial in restoring trust between the two countries. Elsewhere in Italy, 3 more bodies have been found on the wreck of the Costa Concordia cruise liner, bringing the confirmed number of dead to 28. 4 people remain unaccounted for. A US intelligence assessment released today has warned that fresh water supplies are unlikely to keep up with global demand by 2040, increasing political instability and increasing the risk of conflicts over water after the next decade. The report by the Office of the Director of National Intelligence said that areas including South Asia, the Middle East and North Africa will face major challenges in coping with water problems that could hinder the ability to produce food and generate energy. A life-size model of the largest snake believed to have ever existed on Earth has been unveiled at New York's Grand Central Terminal. The Smithsonian Channel has created a film that chronicles the discovery of the 15-meter-long snake that existed more than 60 million years ago. The channel's head of programming, David Royal, gave more details.
This is a find that seems so fantastic that it may appear to be an object of fantasy, a creature that has sprung from a Spielberg-imagined past. And yes, it has a name that evokes a giant and mythic monster. It is called Titanoboa.
That's the news at the top of the hour on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much indeed, James. Before we head to the weather, let's have a look at what's making the headlines on the Australian and New Zealand papers. Very much crime-dominated, it appears. The Melbourne Age arrests as police smash global operation. Police have smashed a child pornography ring on Australia's eastern seaboard, raiding 19 properties in Victoria and New South Wales. Claims that the courts are getting soft on white-collar crime. So instead of sending white-collar criminals to prisoners, they're giving them short weekend or suspended sentences. Going to the Sydney Morning Herald, more crime. Thank God it's over, I've had enough. Finally bundled into the back of a police truck, Australia's most wanted fugitive, Malcolm Naden, turned to police, said, "This beats walking." He was caught finally when a police dog called Chuck sank his teeth into Mr. Naden. Leg and stopped his escape. The Press in New Zealand says man claims murder victim is alive. It really is blood and guts over in Australasia. Simon Hugh Bell is convinced that a murder victim is alive and living, and he has been he is accused of harassing a woman, effectively, who he believes is this dead murder victim. But in a change from all things, our great favourite, the New Zealand Herald, has decided to avoid crime and head, in fact, to the more important subject for many of breastfeeding. Study raises questions over breast milk and says TV guidelines. An official guideline that babies should be fed only breast milk for the first 6 months is being challenged, as it found to 70% of women ignore this advice, and more than half of babies in New Zealand have been fed chips, sweets or chocolates instead. Those are the headlines from Australasia. Let's get the weather now with Thomas Schaffernacker.
The weather, in association with Kiwoni Travel.
And first up is Europe. The weather is looking good. Sunny from Amsterdam to the Adriatic. Temperatures in Athens in the low 20s. And these pleasant conditions will take us into the weekend. However, disappointing for the time being across the Pyrenees, western France. Some rain here, but not for much longer. Here's the end of the week outlook. Friday and in London, 17 and sunny. Nice weekend on the way too. In Frankfurt, also 17 Celsius with sunshine. Prague around 15 with sunny skies. But in Moscow, it's still winter. It's still below zero, with a few snow flurries. North America now, and you could say it's sizzling heats across the eastern US, but this heat wave we've been having is slowly coming to an end, at least for now. In New York City Friday, we still feel like mid-June, but the weekend, wet and much cooler. If you're off to the southern US or the Midwest, it's often cloudy. There's some thunderstorms right now. They had the record heat, well, but it's gone now. On Friday, city outlook then, New York City, a sunny 24 degrees, Washington DC 26, sunny too, in Chicago 18 with thunder showers, and in Los Angeles around 20 degrees downtown there with some sun and clouds. So what's happening? Other parts of the globe, in Cape Town, hot and sunny weekend, around 30 here, Dubai around 29, but it's a little bit dusty at the moment. And in Hong Kong, if you're landing there Saturday, 23 degrees, further north in Shanghai, a cooler 14, also sunny. That's it. I'm meteorologist Thomas Schaffernacker here on Monocle 24.
The time's just coming up to 9 minutes past the top of the hour, and you're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. In a moment, we'll be assessing the Middle East's position in the cultural world. Stay with us.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Esse Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
And a Monocle 24 highlight, yeah.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 e io cosa?
Tama on Monocle 24.
Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
The Middle East is a culturally ambitious place. Abu Dhabi is charging ahead with its Louvre, Guggenheim and Zayed National Museum project on the Saadiyat Island. Qatar has I.M. Pei's Museum of Islamic Art. Oman has its opera house. And now Dubai is entering the cultural race too. It's to build an opera house and modern art district near to the Burj Khalifa. To tell us more about the plans, I'm joined by Anne Summers-Cox from the Art newspaper. Anna, explain to us why Dubai's plans are going to be different from all the other places.
They're going to be different because they are part of a kind of property development scheme. In fact, they're going to be carried out by this very big property company called Emaar. Abu Dhabi's projects are being built directly by government. The great question is this actually really going to happen? Because here we are again. In 2006, Zaha Hadid came up with a wonderful design for them, for Dubai, of an opera house, and then nothing happened. So I think that this is actually a much more modest plan. From what I can make out, it's going to be incorporated in more shopping, some artist studios, galleries, hotels, which are going to be clustered around this tremendously popular hub of this massively tall skyscraper. And if you look closely at what the ruler said, Sheikh Mohammed Al Maktoum, he said it's not exactly going to be an opera house. He said it's going to be a Dubai Modern Art Museum and Opera House District. So I think it's going to be sort of incorporated in commercial spaces. That's basically the difference.
This is the difference. I mean, Dubai has always been the business end of the Gulf. It's always, like you say, been the world's most visited shopping destination. Do you think it will be able to shed that image of being the sort of the flash Harry end of the Gulf by this new district?
I think it's very interesting. Flash Harry, it's a place where there's a real market. There are real people living there who are cosmopolitan, who collect works of art. As a consequence, it has a real gallery scene. Abu Dhabi hasn't really got that. It doesn't have enough variety of in its population to have many collectors. Out of the kind of commercial ferment of Dubai, their cultural life is coming along quite spontaneously. This project sounds slightly more modest and more likely to happen than the previous one. Of course, opera is that going to be opera, or is it going to be, The Lion King? We don't necessarily think Verdi, and indeed, why should we? I mean, Verdi doesn't really say very much to people in this part of the world. They have their own musical tradition, so I hope that they'll develop programs that people will really want to go to.
You talked there about a vibrant gallery scene in Dubai. How is the Gulf perceived from within the art world? Is this now going to be the destination where the top-end art will go?
The Middle East as a whole has begun to be interesting. We're interested in the Middle East because we're slightly frightened of it, apart from anything else, but also because they've suddenly realised that Gulf money, and there's a lot of money, is going into art. And so Christie's have their auction house in Dubai. The Dubai Art Fair, which is going on at the moment, is very well established, dealing in a certain sort of contemporary art that is beginning to emerge with a kind of Middle Eastern flavour to it. Before people tried to sell large quantities of Western, very expensive art there, not with a huge success. So it's beginning to produce its own art. And I can tell you that Tate has its own advisory panel telling it what kind of Middle Eastern art it ought to buy. The British Museum is collecting Middle Eastern art. The V&A has its prize for contemporary Middle Eastern art. So there is a great deal of interest in that part of the world because, as I say, of the political issues and because of the money.
And there's also the idea of whether you need heritage for authenticity, because it's a region that's famed for building so much out of nothing. For example, if you didn't have the desalination plants, you'd pretty much have an awful lot of desert. You mentioned there a lot of things to do with Islamic art. Is that what's going to mark the region out as being different and remarkable?
Well, I'd have thought it'd be quite difficult to create a large number of Islamic art museums with very high quality material because there isn't that much material to be bought. Islamic art means old art. I think it's going to happen in the field of contemporary art. It's in any case where the most vibrant art scenes are in everywhere in the West as well. And has the advantage that there are people producing the stuff at the moment. And it's Middle Eastern art is very interesting at the moment, or some of it's very interesting, because it's actually a kind of safety valve for people's political inclinations. It's metaphors for describing some quite uncomfortable kind of existential situations in which Middle Easterners find themselves, their relationship with power, their relationship with tradition, their relationship with the West, and so on. So I think it's going to be I think the fact that it's a new culture doesn't mean say there isn't going to be culture. I think it's going to be a new culture growing out of the present situation.
The present situation also includes the fact that Egypt and Syria, which were previously seen as the great cultural destinations, are obviously massively unsettled at the moment. So this is obviously the Gulf's chance to shine.
Yes, obviously you don't go to the Gulf to see old things. I still don't really think that it's the place to go for art. I mean, when you're there, you definitely shouldn't miss what there is. But there are a lot of places I'd go to before I went to the Gulf to see art.
We speak at the moment as the Gulf and Abu Dhabi and Dubai as being pretty much a destination. Is that effectively its sole purpose in terms of the art world? Will we ever be able to see it as other than a tourist destination or an art destination?
They're building extremely interesting universities and research places there, and I think that these were going to become very international. Or New York University, for example, is building a completely separate New York University, not just a branch, in Abu Dhabi. It already has students from many parts of the world. One forgets that the Gulf is only 2 hours' flight from India, for example. You know, we think of it as being a long way from us, but it's very close to certain other places. So I think our whole geopolitical sense is going to shift. And if the Gulf manages to have enough centers of excellence, slightly pulling itself up by the bootstraps, it will diversify its cultural mix. It could become a research center, for example. At the moment, it isn't, but there's no reason why it shouldn't become that.
So Abu Dhabi already has its Louvre and its Guggenheim project. Oman has its opera house. Why does Dubai want to make its mark?
Well, because each of these little statelets has its own ruler. Actually, Oman is a completely separate kingdom, but Dubai and Abu Dhabi belong to the United Arab Emirates, but they're united really only up to a certain point. Each of them has a tribal ruler, its own following, its own prestige, and the ruler of Dubai, of the Maktoum family, would feel that if the Al Nahyans down in Abu Dhabi have a splendid museum, he ought to have one too, in order to keep his end up.
Anna, thank you very much indeed. That was Anna Summers Cox, who's the founder of the Art Newspaper. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
With a team of 25 dedicated correspondents and bureaus in Zurich, Tokyo, Hong Kong and New York, Monocle 24 keeps you fully informed on events around the world, around the clock.
For Monocle in Caracas, I'm Sarah Granger.
For Monocle in Abu Dhabi, I'm Christopher Lord.
For Monocle in New York, I'm Aisha Spears.
For Monocle in Tel Aviv.
In Sao Paulo.
In San Francisco.
In North Vancouver.
In Manama. In Paris.
In Ramallah.
For Monocle in Hong Kong, I'm Liv Levichnik.
Bangkok.
Los Angeles.
In London.
Buenos Aires.
In Bogota.
In Toronto.
In Laetitia.
Keeping an eye and an ear on the world. This is Monocle 24.
Wake up in Asia or sip a nightcap in Europe to the Monocle Daily, with 2 hours of analysis and reports on current affairs, culture and business. Hear from experts, authors and editors of far-flung newspapers, as well as our own correspondents, every weekday at 2200 hours London time.
Just coming up to 19 minutes past the hour. Welcome back to Midori House with me, Emma Nelson. Stay with us, because coming up we'll be eating street food in Helsinki. But first we ask the question, is our ability to use language hardwired in the brain? Well, the author Daniel Everett says it's not. He spent 30 years studying languages in the Amazon, and he says he's found proof that it's our culture and not our minds which form our means of communication. He develops this theory in his new book called Language, the Cultural Tool. Daniel came into the studio earlier today, and I began by asking him to elaborate on this theory.
Yes, that means that language is invented by humans and human societies, probably the first invention about 150,000 years ago, to solve the problem of forming communities, because humans are social creatures and we need to establish communities. That's different than saying that language is hardwired through our genes and that it's an instinct like suckling or just a matter of growing, like growing an arm or growing hair. It means that humans are flexible and able to develop different systems for different cultures.
But you say that the language is invented, and the hardwired in the brain argument would say that you can't invent something without actually doing it consciously, without a jump between the brain and the action.
we put things together gradually. So humans have been around for a long time, and we've had the same problem of communication for a long time. So if you just take a common human tool, the original design for that, say a bow and arrow, which is a very simple tool found in all societies because it solves the simple problem of, well, it's not so simple if you're a hunter-gatherer, about how to kill protein that moves faster than you. It looks the same across societies because it's a solution to that problem. But over centuries, it developed so that we have compound bows today that are very advanced because technology is added to the basic design. So whenever language was formed, probably well over 100,000 years ago, when we start seeing the first evidence of cultures that indicate people were communicating well, we've added to that and built on that over the centuries to get the kinds of languages that we have today. But then the human mind is different from other minds. And at the same time, for example, that a child is learning their language so quickly, as the French psychologist Piaget said, they're constructing their identity in the world. And if you study child learning and how children are developing, they're learning so many things simultaneously at an incredible rate. This just shows that the brain is designed to learn things, and language is one of the many things that we learn because it solved the problem. And so not all children learn the same kinds of forms. Languages can vary dramatically between one another.
You say it's cultural, though, and you say at the beginning of your book there's a difference between, you talk about a baby's instinct to suckle. Now, the way that a baby would communicate that instinct would be to cry, and isn't that language? And that's not culturally learned, that's an expression of an instinct.
That's crying is not language, but it is communication. And so language is a specific form of communication. All creatures can communicate. Humans do have an instinct that's related to language, which Aristotle called the social instinct. Humans want to relate to one another, and they want to have community, and they do this by building communication. So if a baby cries, they're making a sound that has a meaning to them, and we recognize the meaning as their parents. It's the same thing when my dog barks. Not exactly the same, because my dog's never going to go on to tell me stories about its grandparents, and the baby will, because the baby has different cognitive abilities than dogs. But initially, babies, like other creatures, are making sounds to get attention for certain things that they need. The different thing about babies that dogs never have is they're able to learn through greater intelligence and through the different kinds of platforms that I talk about in the book. They're able to put together a much more elaborate and complex system and learn how their parents talk.
Now, you say the majority of your work that goes into this book is based on 30 years of studying languages in the Amazon, and you pick on one particular tribe, which uses both what would be linguistic communication and non-linguistic communication. Now, how did this tribe lead you to this conclusion?
Well, there are a number of things that I expected to find based on the idea that language is hardwired into human beings that I didn't find in this group. So it's not to say that the language is simple in some way, because they have complexity where we don't have complexity. But they do have, for example, they don't tell creation myths. They don't talk about the distant past or the distant future. They have the simplest kinship system known. One of the most surprising facts initially was the fact that they have no numbers or concept of counting. And what does that mean? Well, it doesn't mean they're cognitively simple. It means that this doesn't play a role in their society. They tell stories that show all kinds of cognitive sophistication. In their language, their grammar is fundamentally different from the grammars of a lot of other languages, in lacking a specific characteristic that Noam Chomsky refers to as recursion.
Am I right in thinking that your idea of language is what many people would just instantly think of language as being, our ability to distinguish between nouns, verbs, various parts of speech? But when it comes to other enclosed cultures or people who haven't quite learnt the linguistic tools or taken the linguistic tools, that is not really what you describe as language.
Right. So we can communicate in a number of ways. Make gestures that you can figure out what I mean. So if you go to another society, for example, you go to the market in Paris and you point at things, well, because of the social context, the vendor is going to know that you want to buy that object. And because you both share the common value of money and exchange, you can get the idea across without language. It's just communication, putting that together. But if you really want to talk about sophisticated things, things about your emotions, things about science, things that require a great deal more conceptual precision, you have to have language.
So your book has created quite a stir because it goes against a lot of Noam Chomsky's theories, the so-called universal grammar. Can you explain that briefly and why you go against it?
Universal grammar is a very narrow notion of language that talks about structures devoid of meaning that all humans share. And my view is that the human mind has general capabilities that are shared among all human beings, and those general capabilities shape our communication and our ability to talk to one another in ways that makes the conception of language a much broader entity than simply focusing on the structure of the verb phrase or the sentence.
And where are you going to take this theory next?
This theory next will go into another book that I'm working on, which is called Wisdom from Strangers, which is how we learn most from the people who are least like us, and that we have to expand our experiences, because if we just talk like people who talk like us, we learn very little.
And what's it like saying something that contradicts Noam Chomsky?
Well, it's fine if you think you have the evidence to say it. He's not very happy about it. And it's a very popular and strong theoretical framework that has a lot of people working in it. So there's a lot of opposition, but there's also a lot of support, because I think that that's becoming the minority view these days.
Daniel, thank you very much indeed.
Thanks for having me.
And that was the author Daniel Everett talking language there. You're listening to Midori House. Taking us to the news at the bottom of the hour, it's time for some music. This is the Two Bears with the song Warm and Easy.
Yeah, it's exactly that. Like Matt Tracy from Margate said, love is what you want. But still, see fellas, we got your girlfriend thinking I never loved a bear, but tonight I've been drinking.
That was the Two Bears and Warm and Easy. Stay with us on Midori House. The news is next.
LDN TYO. NYC MT4.
In the next half hour on Midori House, we'll hear how Helsinki is trying to develop its street kitchen culture and why China has banned the word Ferrari. First, though, here's James with the latest news.
More than a dozen people have died in clashes across Syria today. In the worst incident, 10 civilians, including 3 children and 2 women, died when their small bus was destroyed in the northern town of Sermin as they tried to flee to Turkey. Rebel troops in the African country of Mali say they've seized control hours after attacking the presidential palace. A spokesperson for the rebels appeared on state television to announce that the constitution was to be suspended and state institutions dissolved. A 23-year-old gunman who said Al-Qaeda inspired him to kill 7 people in France has been shot dead by police commandos as he tried to escape from his apartment building in Toulouse. The man, Mohamed Mera, died from gunshot wounds at the end of a 30-hour standoff with police after confessing to killing 3 soldiers, 3 Jewish children and a rabbi. The British Foreign Minister William Hague has been in Italy in an attempt to restore good relations between the two countries following the failed Nigerian hostage raid 2 weeks ago. Chris McManus from the UK and Franco La Molinara from Italy were killed by their captors during a rescue raid that included British soldiers. Elsewhere in Italy, 3 more bodies have been found on the wreck of the Costa Concordia cruise liner, bringing the confirmed number of dead to 28. 4 people remain unaccounted for. And a US intelligence assessment released today has warned that fresh water supplies are unlikely to keep up with global demand by 2040, increasing political instability and increasing the risk of conflicts over water after the next decade. Those are the headlines here on Monocle 24.
James, thank you very much indeed. A warm welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. It's 32 minutes past the hour. We turn now to the subject of street food. It's part of the fabric of everyday life. It's also so integral to a country's identity. Well, a new book called Helsinki Street Eats discusses the Finnish capital's street food culture and also gives a few hints on how it could be improved. To tell us more about this, I'm joined by one of the authors of the book, Brian Boyer. He's from the Finnish Innovation Fund, which is an independent organisation which rather lovingly promotes the welfare of Finnish society. A warm welcome to Midori House, Brian. Tell us about street eats in Finland, changing both from day to night. Give us an example of what a time-poor, ravenous Finn might be able to pick up on the street.
It's a good question. The maybe most common is snaggari, a hot dog, basically. And you can find it at a number of kiosks around the city, and most of them open really at 2 a.m., midnight, you know, quite late. During the daytime, you can get yourself a coffee and a pula, a bun, cinnamon bun. Those are quite common.
It sounds delicious, if a little hefty. One of the factors that have to be brought into this, obviously, is the fact that, as we mentioned earlier on in the program, some people you might be finding yourself eating these foods at minus 20. How do you A, adapt to eating at that temperature, and B, how do you adapt your food for it to fit?
Well, that's I guess one of the reasons that we were interested in writing the book is to start pushing the boundaries a bit. You know, street food has been a pretty popular story in a number of places, and especially more recently on, say, the west coast of the U.S., where the climate's very easy. That being said, you know, there are plenty of opportunities to mitigate the climate. People find, you know, for instance, here in Helsinki in the wintertime, entirely new cafes pop up on the ice. And they cook food out there. They have drinks and everything available, and it's negative 20 or even less. So, you know, it's more about how high quality the experience is of being out and about on the town. And if there's a good reason and people have enough interest in getting out, they'll bear the cold. The temperature doesn't really stop things in a place like Helsinki. So, in a funny way, that's not as much of a consideration as you might expect it to be.
You were talking about the high quality and the quality of the food. Is street food in itself a destination, or is it something as a byproduct of another activity?
Well, at the moment, we see the street food as maybe a key opportunity for Finland. So here, the snacks that you can get on the street are pretty straightforward. You know, again, hot dogs and these kinds of things are definitely not unique to Finland or Helsinki. And I guess one of the questions that we're asking is, could we use some of our resources that are available here to create a unique offering? So, for instance, the fact that we're in a country that produces a lot of reindeer meat and you can't find a reindeer sausage or something like that on the street is just a curiosity in a way. And so we're looking at ways to broaden the diversity and at the same time up the game in terms of quality. So what we've seen here more recently is a festival that happens a couple times a year called Restaurant Day, Ravintolapäivä. What's unique about it is that it encourages normal citizens, anybody who's interested, to create a pop-up restaurant. And that's been a really fantastic addition to the city in terms of bringing new levels of quality, new experiences, and a much more diverse or broad range of both. But it hasn't stuck yet, so we're interested in how the kind of the verve and the excitement of those festival days can become more a permanent part of the streetscape in Helsinki.
And how do you make it appeal to everybody? Because the image on the front page of your book is of a teenager stuffing his face with something covered in paper. I mean, this is typical street food and it has a very young image. I mean, can Helsinki improve in making its street food classless and ageless?
Well, I think that's, again, one of the key opportunities. So the thing with street food at the moment is that it's really primarily available midnight or later. And so right now I'm actually standing on the street near Esplanadi, which is the sort of main pedestrian mall here. There are a number of kiosks that are all closed. They've been closed all winter and they'll be closed until the summertime. And even during the summer, the hours are quite limited. So how do we make the food available at more times of day, even, is a pretty basic question. And it's something that then starts to open up to new communities. So not just to drunks, but also to grannies or to people who are downtown on a shopping stroll or something along those lines.
And you mentioned a moment ago at sort of diverse influences and many countries, I mean, the United Kingdom is one of the great examples, takes food from diverse cultures and it automatically becomes absorbed into street food culture. You mentioned the dearth of the reindeer sausage on the streets of Finland in terms of street food. Have the Finns got a lot to learn in terms of embracing other cultures into their street food?
Well, that's actually one of the reasons why an organization like the Finnish Innovation Fund is taking an interest in street food, right? So, you know, as such, we don't have a particular interest in say, the restaurant scene. We're interested in street food because it's a kind of very easy way to get into these questions of other cultures, to sort of, you know, step into another culture and experience things in a kind of a light touch or easy way. And so we see actually ways to grow the diversity of it, of the street food offering, as actually a technique of addressing the fact that Finland is opening to the world in an increasingly rapid rate. So in Helsinki, you know, we're looking to see the number of migrants or non-Finnish-born people, residents here, double in the next 10 years. And so we're kind of looking at different ways to ease that transition so that we don't suffer the fate of some of the other Nordic countries or Nordic cities, which have had a difficult time with that kind of transition.
And I understand that people have also started to serve food from their homes as a sort of reaction to the strict food safety rules. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, so that's the Ravintola Päivä festival that I mentioned. And this is also maybe one of the motivations for beginning the work that we're engaged in now. Ravintola Päivä came out of a frustration with how difficult it is to get a restaurant started. And the people who put the festival together expressed that through this idea of building buzz around one day when people are encouraged to sell food out of their homes. And as I mentioned, the kind of spirit of that day is it's actually quite transformative. When you walk around Helsinki, you know, if you take a stroll down Uudenmaankatu, there's quite a different feel. But again, it goes away that evening. It's gone without a trace.
And Brian, very briefly, are you going to be taking this assessment to other countries as well? I mean, where are you going to place Finland in a global street food culture, or are you just going to stick to your work in Helsinki?
Well, our work is focused here, but that doesn't mean that we're not looking elsewhere. So we're really looking to see what's happening elsewhere in the world. For instance, you know, in Sydney, San Francisco, in London, as you mentioned. We're quite aware of what's going on there and trying to find ways for Helsinki to have a unique offering in that context as well. So, you know, to replicate the food trucks of Portland, Oregon, that's going to be a hard game to beat. But we'd like to play a different kind of game and find a different opportunity that Finland can really shine with.
And Brian, very quickly, because I'm afraid time has run out on us, what are you having for dinner tonight?
I'm actually standing outside Dongbaihu, which is probably the best Chinese restaurant in the Nordic region. So I'm quite excited about that.
Sticking with good Finnish fare there.
That's right.
Thank you very much indeed. That was Brian Boyer, who's from the Finnish Innovation Fund and who has published a book called Helsinki Street Eat, which talks about the city's street food culture. You're listening to Midori House. We'll be back with a Mexican court case causing tensions after this break. Stay with us.
Monocle Films is the cinematic companion to the magazine. Our video journalists go off on location to capture on film stories from affairs to business, culture to design. This week we focus our lens on sheep farms down under to witness the new bounce in the Australian merino wool industry.
Well, I'm fifth generation wool grower. Our property was started in 1830. We've been growing superfine, ultrafine wool for 50 years here. I've always been interested in the land and looking after the livestock. And I've always enjoyed the sheep and the wool.
You can watch this and over 250 more films via the programs menu on monocle.com.
The Menu is Monocle's delectable food and drinks program with me, Markus Hippi. On the menu, you'll find out about delicious edibles and mouth-watering drinks. We traverse the globe in search of the pioneers, making a stir amongst the food connoisseurs. We hunt down the wonderful and, sometimes weird, tasty trends that are making a buzz in the food industry.
We've been sort of traveling and collecting stories and collecting projects. So one of the things we hope to do is to connect all these narratives across these different geographies.
Milan to Tokyo, Buenos Aires to Auckland. Each week we send our correspondents to the far-flung corners of the world. We pop into independent bakeries, butchers and wineries to find people passionate about what they make. From French cheese to Bulgarian wine, from Japanese chocolates to South African caterpillar snacks. The menu premieres every Friday at 1900 hours GMT. Join us for a drink where everything is on the menu.
That's The Menu, premiering every Friday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Krug.
Eighteen minutes before the top of the hour here on Monocle 24, and you're listening to Midori House with me, Emma Nelson. Well, the face of Florence Cassé staring out from behind prison bars has featured on pretty much every media outlet in France for the past 3 years. She was sentenced to 96 years in a Mexican jail for kidnapping. Madame Cassé, who's now 37, says not only is she innocent, but she's being made an example of by the Mexican authorities. Well, in the latest developments, a Mexican court has refused to release her after allegations of irregularities in her original trial were refuted. On the phone now to tell us more, we have Miles Esty from Mexico City. A warm welcome, Miles. There's been a huge reaction in France to this, much outrage. What's been the reaction to in Mexico?
Well, Mexico's kind of a mixed bag because, in general, polls have shown that Mexicans are in favor of keeping her in jail, and a lot of that has to do with the way that the case has been presented in the media. One of the problems that both the French government and Cassé's and her lawyers had from the beginning is that she was involved after she was arrested, but 24 hours after federal police actually staged a recreation of her arrest in which they fabricated events that didn't actually happen during the original arrest and broadcast it live on the two major networks in Mexico. So she was presented from the start as guilty, which is actually somewhat typical across Mexico. So there's been people have had that image with them since the start of the case, and it has definitely guided public opinion. That said, legal experts in the country and observers are pretty critical of the case, mainly because there is so much mishandling of justice at all levels in Mexico, from investigating the crimes on the street and the police all the way up into the courts, where there's been a lot of problems with impunity and corruption at all levels. So people watching the legal system are quite critical, while public opinion is more in the favor that she should stay in jail. And again, that also has to do with the fact that kidnapping is a massive problem in Mexico, and people want to see really tough sentences to have it serve as a deterrent.
Now, this case has taken everything to a whole new level, haven't it? It's involved Presidents Calderón and Sarkozy have really come to blows with this. There's been sort of diplomatic incidents as a result.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's been just an absolutely massive deal between the two countries, to the point that it's said that Calderón and Sarkozy are no longer talking. 2011 in France was meant to be a year celebrating Mexican culture. I guess they have a different country each year in which they promote the art, culture, and food of a different country. So Sarkozy insisted that before each event, it would be dedicated to Cassé's, and the Mexican officials involved in this eventually decided that they were not in agreement with that and pulled out and canceled the whole event, which had been multi-years in planning. So that was a big deal, and they've said, the French government has said publicly that they don't approve of this whatsoever, that they think it's a sham of justice and that it will strain bilateral relations between the two countries.
This is, though, just one example of a huge strain of kidnapping that goes on in Mexico. Is it really that important to the Mexicans?
Yeah, it's a huge deal in Mexico, and it shouldn't be overlooked the fact that some of the public opinion towards this has to do with how personal people feel about the fear toward kidnapping. There's been a lot of studies that have shown that kidnapping actually has a lot more detrimental effect on the feeling of insecurity in the society than murder does, mainly because it's so personal and it often lasts for so long and it's so damaging to the families. Even if they do get their relatives back, they get them back traumatized. They spent several months usually trying to negotiate, often with, you know, body parts being sent and the person coming back very, very damaged in many ways. So it is a huge deal for Mexico, and even the government admits that there's about 6 or 7 kidnappings a day, while NGOs tend to push that number quite a lot higher, with the most official of results being around 17,000 a year, which works out to about 50 kidnappings a day across the country.
But the counter to this is, although kidnapping is very high, there is a feeling, isn't there, that there are too many innocent people being jailed in Mexico as almost sort of acting as deterrents or scapegoats for such high crime?
Absolutely. It's one of the horrible paradoxes of Mexican justice here is that, like you said, there's uncountable thousands of people who are in jail on very, very basic or circumstantial evidence, and there are people in jail with absolutely no evidence against them that have been used as scapegoats. Whether or not Florence Cassez is one of these remains to be seen. But yeah, that's a massive problem that legal experts at all levels and all across the country are wanting to tackle. And in some ways, we're hoping this case would help resolve by setting a precedent for federal and municipal police to be held completely accountable to their actions throughout the investigation, including their treatment of prisoners and how they handle evidence and how they present evidence to the media.
So finally, Miles, Madame Cassez has been in prison for 3 years now, and this is just another stage. What happens next to her?
Well, she's been in jail, yeah, since December of 2005. Right now, the ruling at the court yesterday, it was a little confusing at first what was happening, but what has resulted is that the first panel of five ruled in favor of Cassez 3-2, ruled in favor of the proposal that there had been misjustice given to Florence Cassez, but they did not rule in favor of the fact of giving her immediate liberty, which was part of the proposal. So essentially, this has been annulled for now, and a new panel of five judges in the Supreme Court will again meet. It's not clear exactly when that's going to happen. I understand that it'll be within the next couple of months, but no one has been able to give me an accurate firm date. And they will vote again on this. Likely it will not be for her immediate release, but it will be for a re-evaluation of the evidence against her and then a re-sentencing to some degree or re-evaluating the punishment.
Miles Esty in Mexico City, thank you very much indeed for joining us. You're listening to Midori House. Time for some more music. This is Bad Boy, Good Man by Tape 5.
But don't dance, no romance. Feel like dancing, dance with me.
And that was Bad Boy, Good Man by Tape 5. You're listening to Midori House. It's 9 minutes to the top of the hour. Well, we turn now to the issue of censorship, and the F word has been banned in China. Well, the word Ferrari, from parts of the internet at least. And a car crash is the cause. There were rumours that the driver of the car might have been the son of a senior communist official. Well, China is not the only place to keep a close eye on words trending on the internet. It's a new game of cat and mouse played between people who are online and the authorities. Well, to tell us more about this, I'm joined by John Rentall. He's chief political commentator for The Independent on Sunday on the line. Very warm welcome to you, John. Let's just start with this Chinese Ferrari story. How common is it for the Chinese authorities to clamp down on something which to many people outside the country seems just actually quite amusing?
that's right. I don't know. I mean, I think this has just attracted the eye of British journalists, which because it's such an unusual word to try to ban, and it doesn't seem logical. So you immediately ask, well, why are they banning that? And then you learn this story about the car crash that might have involved the son of a high party official. But actually, the Chinese try to keep all sorts of subversive words off the internet in China, like Falun Gong and the names of other banned organizations. And you know, we all know that Google, in order to operate in China, has to accept some form of censorship, and then there's a debate about, you know, whether they've struck the right balance there.
Do you often find the fact, though, that because Ferrari suddenly becomes banned, it becomes a matter of interest, so those previously disinterested in the story suddenly find themselves chasing it?
Yeah, well, I mean, it just shows the counterproductive nature of censorship, doesn't it? Because I mean, I don't know, but I assume that, you know, in China, just as here, you know, there are plenty of teenagers with access to the internet who know how to get around these attempted censorships, and so they would have access to the Western internet, and so they'd be able to read all about it and spread the word by word of mouth. So, you know, in the end, these things are always self-defeating.
How do they actually get around it? They go on foreign websites.
Well, I assume so. I mean, I've got no idea about computer code and all that. But, you know, these young people who keep getting extradited to the United States for breaking into the Pentagon online seem to know how to do these things. And so I'm sure the Chinese youth likewise.
How politically damaging can it be for the authorities to find themselves having to clamp down on a story like this?
Well, I mean, Chinese politics is a fascinating and complicated subject in itself. But, I mean, you know, there is a problem with a regime which is not democratic, which tries to control what people know. And, you know, in the end, they're fighting a losing battle. You know, I mean, they want to control people's morals, and so various words to do with sex are banned as well. But, I mean, it's the political censorship that will get them in the end, I suspect.
It's also the fact that it becomes a game of cat and mouse, doesn't it? Because, like you say, they will never actually keep up with the microbloggers. Is it actually a politically expedient thing to do?
Well, who knows? I mean, they must think it works. And it must work to a certain extent, but that's because of people's the sort of general culture of respectability and the fact that people don't want to be seen to be doing things which are unpatriotic. But, you know, I mean, we know from the history of censorship in our own country that, you know, if you censor particular words, then people will resort to euphemisms and satire and there'll be stories around which attempt to spread the subversive information, and so you can't ever hope to block it. And, you know, technology doesn't actually change the nature of the game; it just makes it much faster.
Now, China wouldn't be the only country involved in this kind of cat and mouse.
No, because Pakistan has a long-running battle, the Pakistani government with blogs and the internet and with texting even. I mean, the Pakistani phone companies were presented with a list of 1,000 words which were banned from texts, and they were expected to delete them automatically.
I mean, 1,000 words is an awful lot. What were these words? Because they would have to be reasonably specific in order for them to be successful. Although, you know, to ban the word "if" would cause, you know, a bit of a problem.
No, well, they were mostly to do with sex. I mean, Pakistan and India, the whole subcontinent, is quite prudish about sex, and the authorities were very worried about the corruption of the youth. But there were quite a lot of other words that got in there which subjected the whole list to ridicule. I mean, there were things like Jesus Christ, and I'm not sure why that was in there. I don't know if it was in there because it was a swear word or because it was to do with some kind of religious discrimination against Christianity. But in the end, as soon as the list became known, it was published on the internet in full and collapsed under the weight of its own ridicule.
Was there any use of euphemisms as well, replacement of words which would just make it delightfully ridiculous?
Well, that's what people... I mean, a lot of the words on there, I don't want to go into them on a family show, but, you know, a lot of them a lot of them I did recognise, but a lot of them I didn't recognise precisely because they were either Pakistani slang or euphemism, and then you're into very difficult territory, because if you use a common innocent word as a euphemism for a rude one, then you're going to end up banning a lot of perfectly legitimate text.
John, the mind boggles. Thank you very much for keeping our morals intact on that item. That's very kind of you, but I shall be Googling it immediately after the end of the show. That was John Rentall, chief political commentator for The Independent on Sunday, talking censorship in China and in Pakistan. Well, we're out of time for today's edition of Midori House. Today's show was produced by Marcus Hippie, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager was Andrew Carter. The Monocle Daily will be back in about 3 hours' time to start the day in Asia. Next on Monocle 24, though, is The Urbanist with Andrew Tuck, so stay tuned for that. But for now, this has been Midori House. I'm Emma Nelson, and goodbye.